Well, I have a lot of material, and I'm hoping that I'll be forgiven for that, because I'm the first speaker at the conference in these Monday morning sessions, so your seats are not sore, and your heads are not yet too full, so I'm going to take a little extra liberty. There's another reason, because if I just go over time just a bit, it'll cut down the questions and the argumentations that will follow. I just make one disclaimer. Obviously, I'm not a scientist. Mathematics was not my favorite topic, and science was not my favorite subject. In fact, when I went to school, I don't remember having any favorite subjects. So basketball or something. But I did have a science teacher that made science interesting, and that was a marvel in itself. He was belonged to our church. He was a Baptist deacon, and he loved science, and when you went into classroom, everything suddenly went alive. And it was the only class in high school I can remember enjoying going to, R.K.B. Dunlop, and I revere his name. But he's not responsible for these things today. I have a few transparencies which we'll be using. Someone will flick on the light, not now, but when I give the signal. I don't know if these drawings will work. We'll see. Now, the question before us this morning is creationism tenable? Now, I'm glad the organizers of the conference didn't ask me to prove creationism, because that would be another kettle of fish, and it would be difficult. It would put me in a very difficult position. To prove creationism would be an impossibility, from my point of view at least. So we're just going to ask ourselves this morning, is creationism tenable? Is it worthy of belief? Is it worthy of support? Is it worthy of our continuing interest in it and promotion of it? We're asking the question then this morning, is the belief in a supernatural origin of the universe, including its life forms, a reasonable belief? If we are to judge things by rationality, for many, the answer, of course, is a resounding no. To talk about creationism is like speaking about the flat earth and belonging to the flat earth society, in which the earth is upheld by pillars. And it shows grave scientific ignorance and primitivism. Now, in 1959, there was a gathering of evolutionists at the Chicago University, and they were celebrating the centenary of Charles Darwin. Imagine that. Well, we celebrate centenaries of Charles Haddon Spurgeon, and they celebrate the centenary of Charles Darwin and his Origin of the Species, which really set the whole idea of evolution into motion. And the keynote speaker was Sir Julian Huxley, a leading evolutionist, and he echoed the sentiments of all of those that were present, because there were no dissenting voices. He says, in the evolutionary system of thought, there is no longer need or room for the supernatural. The earth was not created, it evolved. So did all the plants and animals that inhabit it, including our human cells, mind and soul, as well as our brain and body. So did religion. He then went on to say, evolutionary man could no longer take refuge from his loneliness by creeping for shelter into the arms of a divinized father, a father figure whom he himself has created. So we see that the tables are turned in the mind of the evolutionist. He says that God did not create us, but we are the creators of our own God. And the world and all that is in it, all the variety and all the interdependency, is simply a product of blind fate plus time. Creationism is dead, and Sir Julian Huxley was more than pleased to pronounce the burial rites. But no sooner is creationism dead or pronounced dead and buried than by God's grace it is raised to life again. The good ship Evolution had sprung so many leaks that they could no longer begin to answer the new and startling discoveries made in every field of scientific endeavor, which we'll be looking at in a moment. Creationists also, those who believed the Bible and the God who created all things, began to come out of their closets and challenge evolutionary presuppositions by frontal assaults. And some of you may have attended universities and attended some of the lectures between evolutionists and creationists. Evolutionists who thought the battle to be all but over and won found stiffened resistance and were haunted again with the specter of a return of creationism to the classroom. Now, H. Morris, one of the leading creationists and driving force behind these things, describes the revival of creationism in these terms. Today there are hundreds of outspoken scientists advocating a return to creation and abandonment of evolution, and their numbers are increasing. The evolutionary establishment is becoming alarmed as multitudes of disillusioned youth are recoiling from the precipice of animalistic amoralism and survival of the fittest philosophy, to which two generations of evolutionary indoctrination has led them. Now, this is good news then for you and I who love the Word of God and believe the Bible and believe in the God of the Bible. It is good news because the Bible clearly teaches everywhere that God is a creator God, and that we are His creatures and are beholden to Him. The psalmist says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it." Psalm 24:1. Not only so, but many vital and essential doctrines of the Christian faith are premised on the assumption that He is the potter and we are the clay. Is there then reason to hope that the eclipse of God's creatorhood is over? That the embarrassment that some felt about the Bible's teaching on this matter will be a thing of the past? Is there a reason to be optimistic that a new era is dawning in which God's handiwork will reveal even more powerfully and profoundly the genius beyond the handiwork? And this paper seeks to answer those questions, and that you be left not in suspense. It seeks to answer those questions in the affirmative. Is creationism tenable? Now, what I have to say is going to sound simplistic to some of you who are in the field of science, oversimplistic, but then that can't be helped, because I'm speaking to a wide range of folk this morning, and of course I'm speaking as a very simple person, so it's got to sound simplistic. There'd be something strange about that. But I trust that you'll give me that leeway, because there are always other questions that can be raised, but we're interested in the nub of the matter. We're interested in the essence rather than the particular details that sometimes arise when we look at the scientific field. Well, we have to ask ourselves, first of all, what is creationism? Let us first of all define what we mean by creationism, or what we believe the Bible teaches about the origins of the universe and its life forms. According to Norman Geisler, professor at Dallas Seminary, the following list would be an accurate description of what creationists believe. First of all, they believe in the sudden creation of the universe, energy, and life forms. Secondly, the insufficiency of mutation and natural selection in bringing about developments of living kinds from a single organism. Thirdly, changes only within fixed limits of originally created kinds of plants and animals. Fourthly, separate ancestry for man and apes. Fifthly, explanation of Earth geology by catastrophism, including a worldwide flood. And sixthly, a relatively recent inception of the Earth and living kinds. Now that is, I believe, a fair summation of what creationists believe. You yourself may not agree with all of the points, but nevertheless, I think you ought to be familiar with what we mean when we say that we are creationists, or when we ask the question, what is creation science? Now, the protagonists of this particular point of view are called evolutionists. And they hold that time and chance is sufficient explanation for all the phenomena that we see about us. Now, I'll just give a definition by A.E. Wilder that you might see this more precisely as to what we're speaking about. Wilder Smith says that neo-Darwinians believe that chance, the laws of nature, and natural selection provide a sufficient explanation for the phenomena of life. Everything supposedly witnesses to auto-organization. I may say that's not so simple, but auto-organization is organization from within rather than from without. Everything supposedly witnesses to auto-organization and not to external teleonomy, i.e. according to a plan or according to an intelligence. So this would be the equation then that we would be looking at. Prior to Darwin, it was taught that our present universe consisted of three basic elements: matter, energy, and information. But after Darwin, the equation was reduced to two basic concepts: matter plus energy. Simply put, God was removed from the equation. We are what we are today due to, if you like, a most unscientific concept, according to the evolutionists, and that is the concept of chance. Over 100 years of scientific history has supplanted, if you like, the interest that men had in the who with the overwhelming interest that men now have in the how. As Wilder Smith puts it, hence evolutionary theory is plausible and simple, for it eliminates the theoretical necessity of an extra material source of the teleonomy of life, the plan of life. And so that's putting the question, if you like, in a nutshell. The three essences of matter, energy, and information, or as Darwin started the ball rolling, just matter and energy plus chance. Now the question is the elimination of teleonomy or a planned creation a sound scientific principle? Is there proof that intelligence seems to be behind much of what is and what we experience and what we know of life? Or as Wilder Smith further comments, yet there still remains some major scientific difficulties which prevent the final victory of neo-Darwinianism and its thought. The theory totally lacks, now listen to this, the theory totally lacks experimental or a theoretical scientific base. You see, the neo-Darwinians, or Darwin, has not triumphed, and it has not triumphed so much because of the Christian's stand on the Bible and his insistence upon what the Bible teaches, it has not triumphed so much because it has failed scientifically to prove its point. And I know there are many who would be in horror of that statement, because they think that evolution is science, and science is evolution. But Darwinianism has been undermined by the scientific enterprise, and more so in our generations than when Charles Haddon Spurgeon put his ape on the platform and did a lecture on evolution and had a little conversation with the ape which sat in the chair and looked on. The ape was stuffed, like some ministers. See, Wilder Smith puts his finger on the evolutionist's biggest weakness, which is quite simply, it is unscientific. That's a bold statement, and I think that before we're done, I hope that it can be supported. I believe that it can. It's to that end that I would like to recommend a new book on the market. My voice disappeared. Origin Science, A Proposal for the Creation of the Evolution Controversy by Giesler and Anderson. And I recommend it to you because I found it extremely helpful. And they argue in this book, and I think successfully, that the debate between the evolutionist and the creationist runs aground because there is a failure to distinguish between what they call origin science and operation science. Now that's going to take some explanation, and this first part of the paper is dull. It gets worse. That's the unfortunate part about it. But anyway, I shouldn't make these frank admissions. But you see, in the explanation here, they try to show that creationism is tenable. And the accusation that's often brought against the creationist is that it is a religion and it is not science. And the same accusation has been hurled, of course, at the evolutionist, that theirs is a religion, requires faith, and is not a science. Theodosius Dobzhansky, I think that's how you pronounce it, writes, and he's an evolutionist, about creationism, that creationism should take place among the sciences only if the substance and methods of contemporary science were mutilated to make room for a scientifically worthless doctrine. See, it's for him, it's not a science, it's a religion. To put it into the classroom, you're making room for a scientifically worthless doctrine, a disproved doctrine, according to Dobzhansky. Now, what is behind the statement, though, that he should say that? Well, basically, Giesler would contend that it's a misunderstanding about the difference between operation science and origin science. And don't get too excited. We'll explain it in a minute. But you see, Dobzhansky sees creationism as undermining the scientific enterprise or methodology that has proved so successful in explaining our world to us over the past 100 years. The scientific enterprise, which Dobzhansky is alluding to, is operation science, or everyday science, or run-of-the-mill science. Science which relies on the methodology of observation, testability, experimentation, falsifiability, and at the heart, the causal relationship between the origin of an event and its effect. I'll give you an example. All right? You go over to Africa as a doctor, missionary. You see a very sick lad and diagnose his case as pernicious anemia, whatever that means. You then begin to order the steps that will bring the little lad to recovery. But before this happens, a witch doctor steps into the hut and diagnoses the boy's illness as due to demons. a supernatural cause. He orders that that incantations begin at once to save the boy's life. Now that's an illustration of the difference in Dobzhinsky's mind between science and creationism. And we have to understand what these men are thinking when you say scientific creationism. They think, oh, humbug. They think superstition creationism. Nothing more, nothing less. You see, it's the difference between what they think is true science and creationism. Creationism, they say, is not a science, nor is it scientific in its methodology, because it resorts to the supernatural in a pinch. The God of the gaps approach, which has no place in the explaining of the operation of the universe. The true scientist always seeks the relationship between cause and effect, and his answers always have a natural explanation. And it is this kind of reasoning that rejects creationism out of hand and looks upon it as the real enemy of the scientific enterprise. And in a sense, Dobzhinsky is correct. Now we have to grant him that. To explain how the world operates by recourse to the supernatural is unwise. And like the witch doctor, it can be fatal to mankind's well-being, especially in the area of medical science. As Giesler says, just because scientists did not know the natural causes of meteors, one Lutheran pastor said they were the dirty snowballs of mankind's sins, you see, or the eclipse, or the volcanic eruptions, or the bumblebee's flight, it did not justify the direct intervention of God to explain these reoccurring natural events. Now, they can explain some of these things now, but in the past, they would say, that comet out there, God must have hurled it through space. There's a supernatural explanation for that, because we cannot see a natural cause. You see, in operation science, and because it is operation science, recourse to the supernatural is ruled out. And it does. And does it follow, you see, then, because in operation science, that the supernatural is ruled out, that in events that are of original in their nature or primary, that they have no supernatural cause? Does that follow? If we explain the how, in other words, is there never a time when we ask the question, who? Does the how always swallow up the who? Picture, for instance, a group of men. And they're standing around in front of the first gas engine. And one of them is explaining to the others how it operates. And he goes into great detail. And I don't know how it operates personally. I've never figured out a car motor. Very scientific to get under there and find even the battery. But anyway, he goes into great detail. And he shows the cause and effect of how this motor runs. He shows the chemical balance that is needed, the spark, the oil, the firing of the plugs, the driving of the pistons. He answers all the questions as to the how, to the satisfaction of those standing around in adoration and wonderment, how this engine operates. But then someone asks the question, who? Who? Who made it? Who is the genius behind it? And you see, that is the essence, if you like, of origin science, according to Giesler. It asks the question, who, as operation science asks the question, how. And as Wilder so aptly points out, origin science does not deal with observed present regularities, but with unobserved past singularities. Origin science does not deal with observed present regularities, but with past unobserved singularities. Do you see the difference? Operation science is a science which is concerned with regularly occurring events that are testable in the real world. Origin science is concerned with events that happened only on one occasion and in the past. Or it could happen in the present, I suppose. We'll see about that. You see, just as the natural laws by which a motor functions do not account for the genius of a motor, so too the natural laws by which the universe operates need not be the means by which it originated. So positing a creator of the beginning of the universe and life in no way violates the study of the natural laws of the running of the universe. You didn't get that, did you? I worked hard on that. All right, we'll try this again. How then do we more fully define the difference between origin and operation science? I want to step back for a moment. On January the 5th, what do you call them? Are they from Arkansas or are they Arkansas? He says the expert, Arkansas. An Arkansas judge. No American accents here. An Arkansas judge ruled against creation science and for evolutionism in the classroom on the grounds that creationism is not a science but a religion. He gave the following outline as to the proper sphere of science. It is to be guided by natural law. It is to be explained by reference to natural law. It is tenable against the empirical world. Its conclusions are tentative, i.e. not necessarily the final word, and it is falsifiable. Now we'll explain some of that, but you see, creation science could not meet the categories laid down by the Arkansas judge. Creation science, by its own admission, posits a creator who made all things out of nothing. Such a supposition is not guided by natural law. It cannot be explained in reference to natural law. It is not testable in the empirical world, nor can it be proved falsifiable. It is, according to the judge, a religious statement that falls outside the boundaries of science's normal concern. But you see, this is the point that the judge failed to see, and it's the sadness of it all, was that his strictures belong to the how of science. It cannot be applied to the who of science. Origin science, which is a singular science that happened in the past, unwitnessed, must be governed by different scientific principles as it refers to a singular and unrepeatable event not to be presently observed in the regularities of the universe. You see, the judge's rules must not only apply to the creationist, but to the macroevolutionist as well. Because the macroevolutionist isn't any older than I am, even if my beard is gray. And that came as a surprise. You understand? He wasn't back there either, although he thinks he was. Were you there when I made the world's gone ass? That's where the confusion is. The judge, to be fair, has to apply it to the macroevolutionist. Has anyone ever seen a case of macroevolution? Boy, would they love to get a hold of one of those cases. Can you imagine how that would explode in the front pages of the newspaper? One case of macroevolution. We're having a great controversy in London at the present time. Letters back and forth to the editor between creationist evolution. It comes up every once in a while. Editors love it. Helps them fill in space. Lady writes in, "Oh, creation is religion. Evolution," she said, "is an empirical science." Well, you ask an evolutionist sometime, a macro evolutionist, give me one example, give me one empirical example of macroevolution. One empirical example of macroevolution. Anywhere. An empirical example, meaning I can see it, I can hear it, I can taste it, I can smell it. Just humbug to write such a statement. Sorry. I get a little... Get back to the paper. Back to the paper. Has anyone ever seen a case marker? That's what I was asking, yeah. Don't answer that. These questions are not to be answered. Is it empirical? Is it testable? Is it falsifiable? I mean, falsifiable is that you set out a theory or you set out your experiment and you see if it works. And if it doesn't work, if it doesn't test true, you know that you have to experiment in another direction. Can you put it into a test tube and say, look, macroevolution? Or look, something from nothing? Or look, life from non-life? Or look, intelligent life from non-intelligent life? That's the most believable part about evolution. Someone asked me last night at the fire, they said, "Do you think there's intelligent life out there?" I said, "Do you think there's intelligent life on the earth?" Does it conform to natural law? Does it have any reference to the processes now at work in our universe? That's what we want to answer this morning. As Giesler points out, in origin science, it is necessary to find analogies in the present to these events of the past. Analogies. This, for example, if evidence is forthcoming that life can be synthesized from chemicals without intelligent manipulation under conditions similar to those reasonably assumed to have once existed on the primitive earth. Then a naturalistic secondary cause explanation of the origins of life is plausible. If you could go into the science laboratory and produce conditions that you should reasonably think or assume were once existing upon the primitive earth, and show through that synthesized chemical form without intelligent manipulation that life is possible, then macroevolution is a plausibility. Oh, people go into the laboratory and the scientist goes in there with his robe on and he puts his intelligence to works and he brings all of these things together and says, "Aha, I produce life." But all he has shown, to me at least, is that if there is going to be life that is produced, there has to be an intelligent cause behind the life. If, on the other hand, it can be shown that the kind of complex information found in a living cell is similar to that which can be regularly produced by an intelligent primary cause, then it can be plausibly argued that there was an intelligent cause of the first living organism. That's all we're asking in creation science. You see what's happened here, if you like. If this were a circus, and it's not, we could aptly describe it as the old shell game. You see, Arkansas judge to make scientific principles which only apply to operation science operable against creation science, while allowing the macroevolutionist to pronounce on origins as if the same laws are operable for him, is, to say the least, flying under false covers. As Giesler so aptly points out in his book, science has no right, as science, to place limits on explanations of the origin of the universe and of living things. Ultimately, origins are beyond the scope, listen, of empirical operation science for two reasons. First, origin events are not available for observation by the scientist. Second, they form no reoccurring pattern of events by which to test his scientific theories. And all I'm begging for this morning is that the strictures that are applied to creationism be applied to the macroevolutionist as well. It's simply the unfairness of the situation, the blindness of it, because man ultimately does not want to face his creator. What is operation science? Simply put, it explains how things operate, as I've been made mention. It has to do with the observed regularities or repeatable patterns in nature, whether now occurring or having occurred in the past. Oh, yeah, I got this, haven't I? Crank it up, somebody. Why don't we use it? Just think, kids. Living color. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words. These are only worth 50. Can't have everything here. Move the screen. Oh, that's just... I just put that up. You see, here we have the present. The past is shifted off the page. You notice we have operation science, which is in the present and includes physics, chemistry, microevolution. It'll also include historical science, which would be geology and archaeology. Origin science, if we cut across the page, occurs with the past, and it is concerned with macroevolution or special creation because it has to do with origins. It can also be concerned with supernormal science or parapsychology or CTI, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which we were talking about earlier. Isaac Asimov says that if we receive one intelligent message from outer space, or one message from outer space, we can assume that there is intelligence behind it. Boy, when you look at this universe and see its glories, and Isaac Asimov says there's no intelligence behind it. But nevertheless, he said, if you see one message, a singular event, we can assume that it had a primary origin, which is intelligence. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That belongs to origin science because it's a singular event. But we're concerned here with macro evolution and special creation. So what we're dealing with then in operation science is events that are repeatable, as in physics, chemistry, and microevolution, or in the past that were repeatable in archaeology, historical geology. It is the kind of science that the, oh, I hate to say this word again, Arkansas judge had in mind when he insisted upon its testability in the empirical world. Operation science has as its basic pattern from which secondary or natural causes are the only proper explanation. I haven't got into the providence of God. I haven't talked this morning about natural law. You can raise that in your questions. But is there such a thing as natural law? But nevertheless, operation science has to do with cause and effect, which have natural explanations. Secondary or natural causes are those causes that explain an action. without recourse to the supernatural. Thus, suppose you're a witness to a mudslide, boys and girls. You could say that God reached out of the heavens and pushed the mud down the hill. Or more likely, you would say, because of deforestation and heavy rains, the soil was loosened and it began to slide. You see, a natural or secondary cause then is the proper explanation concerning that event, which is a regular occurring event that can be seen and observed and experimented upon. Operation science then is the explanation of regular reoccurring events. I'm repeating myself, but get it in your mind. In nature, whether past or present, having secondary causes only. Now, if we begin to separate these things and look at origin science, it is concerned with singularities. Events which may occur in the present, as CETI, parapsychology, have occurred in the past, but not on a regular or reoccurring basis. Such events might include the origin of the universe, which is non-reoccurring. Nor is the origin of life, or the origin of new life forms. These may have primary explanations according to the creationist model, or listen, secondary explanations according to the evolutionary model, or a mixture of both according to the theistic evolutionary model. And Giesler's proposal then is this, and this is what I enjoyed about it. There are two basic kinds of scientific explanations, primary cause and secondary cause. Likewise, there are two basic kinds of events, regularities and singularities, either of which may occur in the past or in the present. It is clear that natural secondary causes are the only legitimate kinds of causes to posit for a regular reoccurring pattern of events. However, singularities, whether past or present, can have a primary or a supernatural cause, but whether they have a supernatural or natural cause, past singularities come within the province of origin science. See, there are three events in the history of our world which deal with origins. The beginning of the universe, new life, and new life forms. And that's what we want to look at now. The significance of what I've been speaking about then clarifies some of our thought. We must apply a different scientific criteria or explanation depending on whether it is a reoccurring pattern of events or a singularity. For example, it is misleading to call macroevolution a science in the same sense as you call microevolution, because microevolution is a reoccurring pattern of events. Macroevolution is an event that belongs to origins and has a singularity. Microevolution then falls under the criteria of normal science. Macroevolution must be tested by means outside of the normal scientific method. That's not to say that microevolution may not be used as evidence for macroevolution. That remains to be seen. What is clear is different scientific approach must be used when dealing with either operation or origin science. Now, this is where the paper gets worse. But listen, we do have a science that can be applied in origin science. It is in the realm of the scientific enterprise. It is forensic science. Now, we know maybe a little bit about what forensic science is about. Forensic science is a legitimate science. It's used on a regular basis. And it tracks criminals down. Forensic science usually deals with singularities, unobserved by human witnesses. An example could be a homicide in which no one claims to have seen the crime being committed. In such circumstances, the investigator seeks to reconstruct the crime by means of what? Circumstantial evidence, i.e. residue from the scene of the crime. Analogy, i.e. similarity, such as the trajectory of a bullet shot at a certain angle will always hit the same place at the same point or whatever. The principle of uniformity, which is the present is the key to the past and the basis of all scientific enterprise, that every event has a cause, i.e. the world is consistent and certain causes will always produce the same event. That's necessary for the scientific model. That's the thing that scientists want to cling on to, why he refuses to let the supernatural enter in. But you see, such means then of investigation is able to garner evidence that will build a case either for or against the plausibility of creationism or macroevolutionism. That's why I said I'm glad you didn't ask me to prove creationism. In a nutshell, it means that we must approach origin science or events of a singular nature in a different manner. And that's all Morris is pleading for. Is there no way then that the two views can be evaluated and compared scientifically? Yes. The proper and legitimate non-emotional approach is to set up two carefully defined scientific models, an evolutionary model and a creation model, and then to use the two models on a comparative basis for the prediction of observable data. Though neither is falsifiable, neither is demonstrable, since they ultimately relate to prehistory, their effectiveness in predicting data can be objectively compared. The decision between the two may still be somewhat subjective, but at least it will be informed by scientific fact. So we turn to the origin of the universe. I want to mention that there are singularities in the past that fall under the domain of origin science and of our interest to both creationists and macroevolutionists. And one such singularity is the origin of the universe. Why is there something and not nothing? Now, there are only two possible explanations for reality, friend. There are only two possible explanations. One explanation is that matter is all that matters. That is, matter is eternal, or spirit is eternal. That's the only two explanations for what is, if you like. Outside of those two explanations, you can search in vain for another. So at the outset, the creation model would predict a beginning for our universe. The evolutionary model should predict a universe that is always as it has been concerning matter and energy. But, and this is interesting, recently scientists have come to some remarkable discoveries about the origin of the universe. In fact, the evidence is so compelling that many scientists want to deny what they see. Philip Morrison of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology says, "I find it hard to accept the Big Bang theory. I'd like to reject it." While Alan Sandage of Palmer Observatory said, "It is such a strange conclusion, it can't really be true." And a little more honest vein, Professor Jastrow, who is an agnostic, writes that there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work now, I think is a scientifically proven fact. Now, why did he say that? Well, you see, the Big Bang Theory has caused a lot of disturbance in academic circles. Simply put, the Big Bang Theory states that the universe had a beginning. Robert Jastrow summarized it when he wrote, "Now three lines of evidence, the motions of the galaxies, the laws of thermodynamics, and the life story of the stars pointed to one conclusion, all indicated that the universe had a beginning." The evidence of this statement falls under the category of circumstantial and analogies, but if you look at some of the observations of the present, you put them into the past. The second law of thermodynamics, long a thorn in the side of the evolutionist, indicates that the universe had a beginning. The first law of thermodynamics teaches that no energy is being created or destroyed, that there is a fixed amount of total energy in the universe. But the second law of thermodynamics is the law of entropy. It teaches that the amount of usable energy is decreasing. Bluntly put, that things are tending to disorder, the universe is running down, it is growing old like a garment. Now, if things are running down, the universe cannot be infinite, since it would have an infinite amount of usable energy. The second law of thermodynamics strongly suggests that the material universe, cosmos, had a beginning. Secondly, the universe at the same time is expanding. It is growing larger. And I quote, "The most complete study made thus far has been carried out on the 200-inch telescope by Alan Sandage, and ranging out in space as far as 6 billion light years from us, his measurements indicate that the universe was expanding more rapidly than in the past than it is today. This result leads further to the support to the belief that the universe exploded into being." And a third piece of circumstantial evidence comes from the so-called radiation echo, where Jastrow writes concerning it, "No explanation other than the Big Bang has been found for the fireball radiation. The clincher which has convinced almost the last doubting Thomas is that the radiation discovered by Penzias and Wilson has exactly the same pattern of wavelengths expected for the light and heat produced in a giant explosion." Supporters of the steady state theory, he says, have tried desperately to find an alternative explanation but have failed. Is this then what the creation model predicted? It is. That our universe had a beginning. Jastrow, self-professed agnostic, writes, "The scientific pursuit of the past ends in the moment of creation. Science has proved that the universe exploded into being at a certain moment in time." While Davies writes, "The most important discovery of our age is that the physical universe had a beginning." He goes on even more boldly, "Now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the universe. The details differ, but the essential element in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time in a flash of light and energy." Now, does that mean we prove that God exists? Not at all. Our proof may be circumstantial, and it may rely on the model, and it may be evidential, but it is possible, as some insist, that something did come from nothing. Or hydrogen atoms are spontaneously appearing in the universe to keep it from running down. But there is a tremendous price to be paid for embracing such strange conclusions. And the price is this: the sacrifice of the keystone of the scientific principle, which is that every event has a cause. Spontaneous hydrogen bombs or something from nothing means an indeterminate universe, a universe subject to whim and fancy. The very kind of universe the scientists have sought to avoid. Science has proved the universe had a beginning. to avoid its own conclusions by random happenings is to abandon its own scientific principle, a rather unscientific way to act. Now, how did life begin? That's the second thing, the origin of life. Well, I'm running out of time, aren't I? I was hoping to avoid the questions at the end. But we'll have a little fun with this, I think. How did life begin? The second concern of both the evolutionist, macro, and the creationist, the origin of life. And we're talking here of what is sometimes referred to as chemical evolution. Now, both creationists and evolutionists agree that at one point in time, there is no life on Earth. We both agree on that. But then how did life begin? The evolutionists teach that life began with a simple cell, divided, and it becomes two cells. From that simple cell, all the present-day life can be explained. Some scientists deny that today and say there were many cells. The problem is there's no such thing as a simple cell. The cell is one of the most complicated machines in existence. Now, I was going to take you through the history of the cell, but I can't. So I pass that all over. Believe me. Then, will you believe me when I say it's complicated? Now, what I wanted to take you back into the nucleus of the cell, to the DNA molecules. And this is interesting, boys and girls. This is where we're fearfully and wonderfully made. You're made up of cells. You're made up of a billion cells. That's the building blocks of your body. Every one of those cells has a nucleus. And every nucleus has those DNA molecules or the genetic code. And I guess in the human it's, 23 chromosomes? Every one of those cells contains the blueprint of your person. If you could take one of those cells and get it going again, you would have another clone, wouldn't you? And the interesting thing about those cells is this, that every one of those cells has a code. And it's just like a great big factory. Food going in and out. It has workers, enzymes, breaking down the food, carrying the chemicals. The sperm and the egg unite. And they form that initial cell. And then they divide. And when they divide, the chromosomes double, don't they? And then you have the same number of chromosomes in each cell. But now we want differentiations of cell. You don't want to look like a blob. I don't want to look like a blob. So God says, let them have hair and skin and bones and eyes and nose and features. And so in those chromosomes are these DNA molecules. And these DNA molecules give the information as to whether those enzymes are going to produce like cells, which are skin and hair and bone, as I understand it. The important thing that I just wanted to say, and I had to rush over it, is simply this, though, that there's a code in the molecules. There's a code in the molecules. How do the enzymes know what to do? Because there is a fixed code. So that if you think of your chromosomes as a filing cabinet, and if you think of the cells or the filing drawers as genes, and if you go into the blueprint, that's the DNA molecules, and they have a code, and when they hit the code, they know exactly what kind of cell to replicate. It is mathematically impossible for that code to arise at a chance. It's fascinating. You want to study it sometime. I want to leave you with some of the fascination, but I have to hurry on. But listen to what Professor Andrews says, and he's rhapsodic about it. God in creation is like a composer who uses a single instrument like a piano and a single code made up of separate musical notes to create a large number of different pieces of music. These may range from simple preludes to piano concerts. God has used a single substance, DNA, and a simple code of only four symbols to create the vast range of living things from the simplest virus to the wonder of the human brain. This could no more have been the work of chance or accident than could the Moonlight Sonata be played by mice running up and down the boards of my piano. Codes do not come from chaos. The shaping of living things by chemical evolution is an implausible scenario. The DNA code demands primary, not secondary explanation, as it is mathematically impossible for a code so ingenious to spring up randomly. And neo-Darwinians, writes Wilder Smith, postulate the development through chance and auto-organization of the most refined coding system for a machine the cell ever seen. This cell machine is more complex than any machine ever invented by man. What information engineer would attribute the development of a code and a code content to chance? Such postulates would be refuted immediately in all areas of science except the neo-Darwinian biology. Plain common sense eliminates such ideas in any other realm of science but biology. But biology retains this plain nonsense in the sole interests of materialistic philosophy. We're walking along the beach, you and I together. And this will explain to you chemical evolution. Ha, this is really something. As we walk along, I kick something with my toe. Out pops a rubber ball. I say, aha, a child yesterday lost his rubber ball while playing on the beach. You say, no, no, far too simple of an explanation, my friend. Let me explain how that rubber ball got here. That rubber ball, and this is Professor Anders' illustration of chemical evolution, that rubber ball got here from an island. What happened was there were two trees growing side by side. There was a rubber tree and there was a coconut tree. Now, you see, what happened is that the coconut fell from the coconut tree, obviously. It hit a rock, it chipped the top. The ants got in, they ate out the whole thing, and there was nothing left but a shell. Another coconut fell and it hit the branch of the rubber tree. The rubber tree began to drip its rubber, or latex, or whatever it is, sap. I told you I was unscientific. Into the shell. Drip, drip, drip. Filled up the shell. In the meantime, a windstorm came up. And as the windstorm blew, it brought in the minerals necessary and it came into this sap. And then a leaf fell upon it and it covered the hole. And then the waves come in and it took up the coconut and it swept it out into the ocean. Bounced it around. The sun heated it and it churned it around. And then it threw it up on our beach here, hit itself on a stone, cracked open. Voila, the rubber ball. Now, do you believe me? What if I said, would you believe me? If it took 100 years. That's plausible. You don't like 100 years? How about 1,000 years? How about 1,000,000 years? That's chemical. That's chemical evolution. That's chemical evolution. You see, the whole point of the story of chemical evolution is like our rubber ball story. No step is impossible. The whole thing is highly improbable. The atmosphere for these cells had to contain some molecules and not other molecules. Lightning or ultraviolet rays had to be present to bring them together, but not break them down again. There had to be no oxygen in the universe, and later on there had to be oxygen. The new larger molecules had to be washed down by rain, but the smaller ammonia molecules which dissolve in the water had to remain in the sky. Larger molecules, though not soluble in water, had to stay in the water as it ran over the rocks and filtered through the soil. The molecules, though lighter than water, had to remain under the water to avoid destructive ultraviolet rays. They had to collect in an organic soup and link together. Some catalyst to cause them to link up. The right organic molecules had to be present in the right amount to link up in proteins and DNA. Somehow the special coded order of the protein and DNA had to happen. Organic droplets had to be formed and stay long enough for something to happen inside, which would then bring them into living cells. And they had to stay alive long enough to learn how to divide. A single cell animal does not live very long. And at first there had to be no oxygen in the atmosphere. Then there has to be oxygen in the atmosphere. Is it likely? Is it probable? Or is it simply impossible? Well, give me 1,000,000 years. You can take 1,000,000,000 if you like, but it just won't happen. It just won't happen. Well, so much for the rubber ball.
Can I have a few more moments here? New life forms. Our last final concern is to do with new life forms. Granted for a moment that life began from a single cell in a primordial soup, but how did it arrive at such a variety and complex of organisms? And you know how Darwin did it? Darwin, he was a breeder, and he said, this is how it was done. He said, we know something about special selection. Well, it was all done by natural selection. All we have to do is natural selection. And what he did was he extrapolated back from his experience of breeding, and he said it was all done by nature. Is it a proper link between natural selection and special breeding? And this is what one scientist said. It's unfortunate that Darwin ever introduced the term natural selection, for it gives rise to confusion of thought, because the action of man in selective breeding is not analogous to the action of natural selection, but almost the direct opposite. Man has an aim and an end in view. Natural selection can have none. Man picks out the individuals he wishes to cross, choosing them by characters he wishes to perpetrate and enhance. He protects them and their issue by all means in his power, guarding them from the operation of natural selection, which would speedily eliminate many freaks. He continues his active and purposeful selection from generation to generation until he reaches, if possible, his goal. Nothing of this kind happens or can happen through the blind processes of indifferent elimination and differential survival, which is miscalled natural selection. Are there other objections to the term natural selection? One has to do with the development of the species itself. For instance, take a rabbit named Rabbit. He's faster than his slow-footed rabbits. His slow-footed friends, brothers, they get all eaten up. But he keeps producing rabbits who are able to escape all the foxes and the wolves and the lynx out there, and they become very rabid indeed. But what have you got? You've got rabbits! In fact, what natural selection done is preserve the species. It makes it more streamlined so that it will not lose its specific nature. Rapid rabbits. That's what you're left with. The second problem will be the number of useless organs in the transient stage of development. And this is something I can't understand. While the fly is waiting for his wings, the bump on his back could be positive hindrance to his survival. Why would an eye develop at all? Granted, it's the most useful instrument in the earth, but in the early stages of unseeing, it would be as useless as no eyes, and therefore not likely to develop any further. Moreover, the absence of any trace of undeveloped freaks, and there must be millions of them, not even one blind mouse squashed under an elephant's foot and preserved in mud is available to us. All creatures meet us in the fossil record, and they are functional in their environment which they are found. Time alone cannot explain the infinite variation between species that are closely related. I got to end, don't I? Okay, I come to my conclusion. You can ask me some questions then about these other things. I just want to say one thing in conclusion as we draw it to an end. Listen, when we talk about creation and evolution, we not only have to talk about biological, but we have to face the fact that evolution has wreaked havoc on our planet. And those who are perpetrators of the evolutionary doctrine are responsible for the criminality that has been produced in the genocides of our generation. And we can't just stand up and teach theory and doctrine without asking ourselves, what is the fruit of that theory and what is the fruit of that doctrine? The gas chambers and Auschwitz have a direct link to the origin of species. And I don't care how you slice it. You think that man survives because he is the fittest, then Another man that doesn't look like you, doesn't have the same color skin, doesn't have the same background. He is a lesser species which you can put in a gas chamber. And Darwin, in his own writings, foisted a racist doctrine, and so did Sir Julian Huxley, a racist doctrine, and Hitler swallowed the racist doctrine and propagated it in his Nazi Germany. Listen to me. If we ask ourselves, what is the link between abortion and the awful slaughter of millions of babies? It's because men have come to the place where they think that all they're producing is another animal that doesn't have value and doesn't have a soul. They don't realize that that which has been created in the womb has been created by Almighty God. God has a destiny for it. And it goes back to the origin of species. Something that is close to my heart is McDonald's. I say, what's McDonald's got to do with my heart and the origin of species? I've got a fantastic brain, I'll tell you sometimes. But listen to me. All those people that are marching around and saying, don't eat hamburgers. It has a direct relation to the origin of species because a hamburger supposedly is related to me and you. And we're eating our brothers out there. And that hurts. God made us different from the animals. He created us in His own image. God created us that we might have fellowship with Him. And if I just conclude on this remark, we are the only creature we can stand and look in the face of our Maker. All the other creatures look to the earth. And the most horrendous thing about the doctrine of evolution is it denies the creatorhood of God, man's responsibility to his Maker, and the day when each one of you will stand and be judged for the deeds done in the flesh. Amen. Can't believe I stopped. Right, yeah, see. Turn off the tape.